We are continuing our series on the I Am statements from the book of John. John is the last writer of the gospel accounts. He likely wrote towards the end of the first century, at the end of his life. And his point in writing the gospel account was to show the deity of Jesus. He's trying to show that despite what doctrines were around in his day and age in the first century, that the Jesus that the people were hearing about was actually God in the flesh. And to make that point true, and to hit it home for a lot of his readers, he used the statement, I am, when Jesus spoke about himself. And that I am statement is a kind of a callback to Exodus chapter 3 and verse 17, when the Lord identified his name before Moses as the I am that I am. And so he is the one who always has been, always will be, using that present tense, I am, to define his nature and his attributes. And thus far, we've talked about a couple of ways in which John uses that phrase, I am, in relation to Christ. Our first week was, I am the bread of life. Jesus said, he is the true fulfillment of the bread that comes down from heaven, not the manna that the forefathers ate and then died, but he's the bread of life, or the life-giving bread, literally. He also identifies himself as the light of the world, not only as the Creator God made light as we know it in this universe, but the light of our life, talking about a spiritual light as well. Next, last week, we talked about him being the door of the sheep, the idea that he is the one that is able and authorized to allow people to enter into the flock of God, and he is, of course, the good shepherd as well. That was last Sunday afternoon. And so all of these descriptions thus far have tried to illuminate for us who Jesus really is. He's using that phrase, I am, which is a callback to his deity, but he's trying to define himself in a very prescriptive way. The first two, I am the bread of life, or the life-giving bread, and I'm the light of the world, are used almost for rebuke or correction, meaning there are people that were coming to Christ to get physical bread, like the miracle he performed by multiplying the loaves that were there on the seashore. They came to him for more physical bread, and he, in a way, kind of corrects their behavior or rebukes them by saying, you're seeking after me for physical bread, but I'm the life-giving bread. And also, the idea of him being the light of the world, there are folks that are living in darkness, and they love that darkness. The absence of light is how we define darkness. And because he illuminates where people are, good and bad, there are some folks that would reject him. So the first two attributes of who Christ is in the great I Am statements, they're corrective in behavior. The next two are a little bit neutral in the sense that he's the door of the sheep. The Pharisees, the Jews, didn't see him as the entryway to the fold of God. They were trying to get in the pen in some other way by climbing over the sides, he describes there in that context. So it's a little bit rebuking there for the Jews, but kind of comforting for those that want to come to Christ through God's terms. And then the last one, we talked about this, I'm the good shepherd. That's just a comfort, right? He protects us. He leads us beside still waters for his name's sake. He wants to care for us and defend us against the adversary. Very comforting. And the ones that we're talking about today, the idea of him being the resurrection and the life and the way, the truth and the life this afternoon, they're also very comforting. And I want to kind of begin with that mindset, because that flavors the text for us we're going to be reading today. If you know that Christ is trying to comfort someone by identifying himself as the great I am, and then he defines I am something very specific, that can be a great comfort to us when we're in times of need. So let's begin our conversation this morning looking over in the book of John, chapter 11. This is a longer text, I'm aware. Last week, I'm so proud of myself, 23 and a half minutes. So I just want to set that pace for myself today as well to keep us going at an efficient speed. John 11 and verse 1. Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, when you first read that, it may sound like Jesus says, well, he's not going to die, not a big deal. If you know the story, Lazarus dies. So we're going to figure out why Jesus didn't contradict himself as he made that statement that it's not unto death. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. That's almost kind of a funny statement because he loves these people. They're suffering, but he doesn't go to them immediately. That's kind of the opposite of what you would expect. If you love someone and they need you, you don't just hang out for 2 more days and then go, but that's what Jesus did. In verse 7, after this, he said to his followers, let us go to Judea again. His disciples said to him, teacher, the Jews were now just seeking to stone you, and you're going to go there again. He says, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. This is one of those passages where I wish I just had a little bit more detail on what he meant. We know that at this point, Lazarus died, and he is in the grave. Where his soul is, we have some questions about. We assume he's probably in paradise. The idea of him being a follower of Christ, living faithfully, it would be a pretty safe assumption, we might say. But Christ calls it sleep. And so again, I have questions. I guess maybe I'll figure it out one day. In verse 12, the disciples said to him, Lord, if he's sleeping, he will recover. So they were missing the conversation that he was trying to put down. He's saying he's fallen asleep. Well, great, he's taking a nap. He's getting some chicken soup. He's taking some medicine. He's going to be okay. Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest and sleep. And he just said plainly, he's dead. And for your sake, verse 15, I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. So Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us go that we may die with him. What in the world do you think we're about to do right now? Did he think that they were going to have to die to go to paradise to believe? I don't know, but whatever the case, that's not the plan. So verse 17, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. So the 2 days, 1 day journey likely. So he died the day before. He said, we'll go there in 2 days. Verse 18, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So we're opening this scene here with a funeral setting. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Now, I want to pause here and make this note. These two individuals are as polar opposite as I can find as two women in the text of the New Testament. We find Mary often engaged in learning at the feet of the great teacher Jesus, which, by the way, was not a woman's place in that custom. Christ didn't run her off, didn't say this is just a man-only time. She was there to learn from the Son of God, and she did just that. And then Martha, she was very concerned about other things. I wouldn't say less important things, but maybe in comparison to learning from God himself, maybe less important things. She was concerned about keeping house, about making meals, about usually what the female servant of the house would be accustomed to do in that culture. And so we see an occasion in which you find Martha trying to get the meal ready for the day, it would seem, and Mary's not helping her because she's learning at the feet of Jesus. And so Martha thinks it's a great idea to try to get the Son of God to enlist Mary's help to help Martha in the kitchen, I would just say simplistically. And that's not how it goes down. Christ says she has chosen the better part. She's learning from me. Martha, Martha, right? They're concerned and troubled about many things. So the idea is she's anxious about getting the meal ready, and meals are important because we are human after all. But it's not the most important thing when it comes to Christ being in your home. And so we know that story. We know the kind of relationship they have together. And so it's interesting to me that when Martha hears that Christ is coming into town after their brother has been dead for 4 days, whom he loved, she goes out to meet him. You would think it would be Mary, who learned at his feet, that seems to be more spiritually minded, to kind of use that in a simplistic way. But Mary stays in the house, grieving, no doubt, and Martha goes out to see the Lord. Verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." I mean, if you can't feel that in the text, then you've not experienced grief. Because when you're grieving, your mind tries to rationalize. It tries to make things fit the emotions that you feel. And they don't fit. That's the whole point of grieving. And so Martha here says, "Lord, you're too late. If you were just here a couple of days ago, we wouldn't have lost your friend and our brother." So she's trying to rationalize, what in the world is more important than you caring for your friends? Verse 22, "But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." So she's saying, look, I don't know why you're so late, but I still have faith, I still have belief, I have confidence that you're still in control, which is probably the safest spiritual place you could be when you're grieving, is to say at the end of the day, in all honesty, God is still in control no matter what. And then verse 23, Jesus said to her, no words of comfort, really, just your brother will rise again. Now, I am puzzled by the next verse because it's so complex for someone who is a female, who's in this society, in this culture, with this educational level, to be able to ascertain this truth of verse 24. It's very complex for someone given all her deficiencies, not because she's a woman, but because of her culture, because of what she knew. She knew this, which many of us maybe don't know. She said, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Now, I say that's so complex because there's an entire sect of the Jews that were the second ruling class of the Sanhedrin called the Sadducees. And they were absolutely convinced in their theology that there was no afterlife. The law of Moses was for living here and now and being blessed well, and then you die, you go to Sheol or the pit or the grave, and that's it. Which is a pretty fatalistic idea. But Martha knew more than they knew, and they had doctorates in their law of Moses studies, if you will. So I'm just blown away that they were able to pick up enough truth from Christ while he was doing his ministry that she could make that statement. And that was at least some comfort to her. She goes, if you were just here 4 days ago, he wouldn't have died, but I still have faith in you. And he goes, he's going to rise again. She goes, yeah, I know. You told us and you taught us about the resurrection of all mankind for judgment on that last day. I'm aware of that fact. And that apparently gave her some comfort to know that's not the end, which, by the way, is a comfort to know that when someone leaves this physical world, that's not the end. However, Jesus says something a little bit puzzling here. Jesus said to her, "I am," again, which is a powerful statement, "I am the resurrection and the life." Let me pause there. Because that statement, for the longest time in my brain doesn't work the way it's supposed to, I don't think. But in my brain, whenever I read that, and I go, well, of course, because what he means there is that he is going to resurrect Lazarus from the tomb and say, boom, here's a miracle, I'm the Lord. That's how I've always read it, which I know is not the right way to think about it. But that's not where we are yet. I want to just camp out here this statement, because imagine that you are Martha and you've gone out to meet your Lord, who you know has the answers, has the power. He's the prophet. He's the anointed one of God. You go and say, I'm grieving. If you were just here, you could have fixed it, but you didn't. But I still have faith. He's going to rise again. Yes, I know in the future he's going to rise again. Thanks, Jesus. That's not what he says. What she is saying is not, you are the resurrection and the life. She's thinking, you will be the resurrection and the life. Don't miss the present and future tense here in this context. She says, verse 24, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection, in the future, on the last day before judgment, and go on to paradise. I know that. He goes, no. I am the resurrection and the life. Not the I will be the resurrection and the life. And that's completely different. That present tense article is powerful. Because when we are going through something, and our mind goes, well, it'll all be better in the future. Jesus is saying, no, it needs to be better right now. Now, I'm not saying that we can't grieve. I'm not saying we can't feel lost, because we're going to. That's a reality. But to say, I don't understand it, but we'll all figure it out one day because Jesus will be there, that's a wrong theology. It's incorrect. Jesus says, I'm not going to be there. I'm here right now. I'm with you right now. As you're grieving, as you're processing loss, as you're going through the emotions of this world, I want you to know I am right now the resurrection and the life. Let's keep reading. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives, present tense, and believes in me, present tense, shall never die, future tense. And then he says, do you believe that? I love those little questions. Because those little questions we kind of often mention, Jesus never asked questions. God never asked questions because he doesn't know the answer. He wants to know if we know the answer. Now, the dumb illustration that comes to my brain is all I got for you. So whenever we're at the dinner table as a family, we're having our meal together. Maddie's eating usually cheese or pizza or mac and cheese. There's always cheese. And she's eating, and then she'll finish and she's like, oh, all done. I'm like, oh, okay. She goes, oh, so all done. Cookie? And we're like, excuse me? She goes, cookie? And we say, do you want a cookie? Do you think we know she wants a cookie? Of course she wants a cookie. She wants all the cookies. We'll say, how many do you want? She goes, one, two. And then we'll give her two. She goes, one, two, three. Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. And she'll go to 20. She'll ask for 20 cookies. We say, no, we know you want 20 cookies. You can't eat 20 cookies. We're not good parents. We do. So we ask the question, do you want a cookie? Not to ask her because we don't know, but because we want her to affirm that she's really aware of what she's asking for, how to ask for it, and by giving it to her, we are showing her love for her parent, as her parents. And so he says, verse 26, do you believe this? Verse 27, look at her response. She says, yes, Lord, I believe that you are, present tense, the anointed one, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. Lord, I know that you are, and I know that you will be. That's her answer. And I love it because it's so perfect for the text. It just so happens to fit the pattern here. She says, Lord, if you were just here in the past, this wouldn't happen in the present. I know in the present you will be there. He goes, no, I'm here right now. Do you believe that? I know that you are the Son of God and that you will be coming. That's her answer. The mindset is changed from the past, where she suffered loss, and then from the future, where she has hope, to the present, where Jesus is. And right now, folks, is right now, the present, where Jesus is. Verse 28. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. I wonder if that was true. I suspect that maybe Jesus didn't say, go get your sister Mary and bring her out here. I think maybe Martha said, I need to get my sister out here right now. He's calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him on the outskirts. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, thinking that she was going to go to the tomb to weep there. So you have the professional comforters there in the room, doing their best to console a grieving woman. And she gets up and books it out of there. They say, oh, she's going to the tomb. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was, saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved. The word picture there is a bit more literal. It means almost like there's butterflies in his stomach. His insides are moving with compassion. He feels this grief, this emotional welling that he's been stifling thus far. And his spirit and was greatly troubled. He said, where have you laid him? They said, Lord, come and see. What did Jesus do? Jesus wept. Why? Why? From what he just told Martha, I am the resurrection and the life, that's a pretty bold statement, and then you go and cry about it. Don't miss the emotion here. Jesus loved this man who died, and he knew that he was dead. And he knew he was going to raise him from the dead in just a couple of moments, but he still had that emotional outburst. And it was not a sign of weakness, I might add, for my own sake, who cries in sermons more than anybody you've ever met in your life. Emotion's a part of the human existence. We have emotion not just because of neurochemicals that go off in our brain or trauma or any of that. We process emotion because God feels emotion. If God didn't feel emotion, Jesus wouldn't cry here. He'd just go in there, raise him out of the tomb, and then go on about his day. There's an emotional component to life. That's why you have the books of 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles that are history and that are fact. And then you have the beautiful poetry of the outpouring of the human heart in the book of Psalms. They go hand in hand. You need logic, but you also need emotion. When they combine together, you find humanity. And so Jesus here knew, I am the resurrection and the life. I'm here right now. I am your life. But also, I know how you feel. I've been there. It comforts me a little bit to know that when I suffer loss in my life, when I miss people who are no longer here, Jesus knows how that feels. He's been there before. He's cried over someone that he lost. Verse 36, the Jews even said, see how he loved him. But some said, and didn't they always, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? The answer, yeah, he could have. But you wouldn't have this text to reflect upon, to learn from, be comforted by, to know that it's not just a future hope that we have, but a hope here right now with us. Jesus, verse 38, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. He said, take away the stone. Martha said, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days. He said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? I took away the stone. Jesus lifted up his eyes, which is where we get the expression of him being up there somewhere, right? Although he's within us and we are within him, he's up there somewhere in our minds. Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice. Now, I would love to know how that sounded in reality. Did he yell it? Lazarus, come out. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." What a moment. What a moment. Jesus loses someone he cares about. He tries to comfort the sisters. They both have the same complaint. If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. Looking at the past. And then they look at the future and say, "We know he's going to rise again. He'll be there at the last day. We'll miss him until then." But then Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life," and proves his case by making Lazarus, he who died, walk out of that tomb. Let's close our thoughts out by looking over the book of Colossians, of all places. In Colossians chapter 3, there is a statement here about putting on the new man. When you become a Christian, it's kind of like a spiritual death. It's kind of like you're saying goodbye to the man of sin, and you're resurrected from the water, if you will, of baptism, to walk with a new body. You're a new person. You have a new master, new Lord. And so when Paul talks about what it means to be a new person as a Christian who's been raised, resurrected from the old man of sin, he uses that expression here in chapter 3. So in verse 1, he says, "If then you have been raised with Christ," which is kind of like us going down into baptism, into the tomb, and then out of that watery grave in resurrection, "seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are here on earth." So you can kind of see a little parallel here between where Mary and Martha were, things that they lost on this life, not focused on Christ being with them. That's kind of parallel. And then verse 3, "because you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life," present tense, "appears, then you also will appear," future tense, "with him in glory." This verse is powerful because it shows us the way that we apply the idea of Jesus saying, "I am the resurrection and the life." The breath of God that was breathed into the nostrils of man in the beginning. Those combination of spirit or pneuma or breath and the body, man became a living soul instead of Adam. And so when Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life," he's saying, you know that life, that spark of life that we gave you in the beginning? That is who I am. Your life is in me. I am your life. I am your resurrection, now and in the future. That's why that powerful statement, "I am the resurrection and the life," is so impactful to us and hopefully comforting to us as well. So this morning, we identify Christ in a little bit more detail here. We see him in a moment of weakness and emotion and sorrow, but also in a moment of power in which he identifies himself as being the resurrection and the life for us right here and right now. If you need access into the resurrection and the life, the commandments of God are not burdensome. They are quite easy to obey, to follow, and to give your life to him by obeying his simple commandments to become a follower of God. If we can help you obey those commandments, or if you want to come back to God through prayer and repentance, please respond now by coming forward as we stand and we sing.